Power Listener, as I said, we're getting into it, and now we're right into it. And as I said, we're joined online by Sissy Abigail Butcher, who is an associate in employment law at Cliff Decker Hofmeyr. Sissy Abigail, kunjani?
Hi, Sifiso. How are you? You got a
one, Danny. Ah, you see, there's progress. There's progress. Good donkey, and I'm good. Thank you very much. It's muy bien, bueno, whichever one you're using as a language of medium language, I can try on this one as well. But yeah, welcome to our show, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me,
Sifiso. 100%. And, you know, it's quite an interesting one, Abigail, is that we find ourselves one where there's lots of social pressure around employment relations and labor relations at this point in time that is actually changing the way in which policies are designed at a corporate level or enterprise level. We've seen some of the corporates already starting to pilot four-day work weeks. And I know a cousin of mine is working now with Amazon, and she said she works, it's quite a silly work structure, I guess, for her in terms of hours. She works 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. because of the global time frame issue, but she works 4 days a week, which she really welcomes at this point in time. And I think we also heard Ernst & Young a few months ago, if not last year, also saying that they were going to pilot that as well. And so lots of interesting developments around this 4 day work week. And and now, of course, now that you're piloting it, what does it actually mean? And I think those are all the things that us who aren't, legal eagles may not necessarily understand in terms of the implications that it may have for labor relations and employment equity and all of the other things that are related to that. And so maybe let's take a step back, Sis Abigail, around that particular thing and say, what is the governing law around number of days worked per week, etc., and employment equity associated with that and all of those things? Because we read our contracts, they tell us the hours that or the days we're supposed to work, but maybe many of us don't really understand the underlying legal framework that underpins that.
100%. So I think it's a very interesting place to start, and understanding the legal context is important, but I also think understanding what's brought us to this point is also very important. And as you're saying, a lot of corporates starting to model this kind of four-day work week. But I think what's quite interesting is a lot of first world countries are doing across the country, across the sector, across the full labor workforce in the market, and this blanket approach to a four-day work week. And when I go into the explanation on the legal implications, I think it'll become a bit clearer that I don't necessarily think that that model is going to work too well in the South African workforce. But from a legal perspective, for employees earning below the threshold, the Basic Conditions of Employment Act is the piece of legislation we're looking at. So Section 9 of that act, which obviously, as it implies, regulates basic conditions, deals with ordinary hours of work. And what that says is it says that the hours of work cannot exceed 45 hours in a week, and interestingly, 9 hours in a day if the employee works for 5 days or fewer. So, you know, your cousin's example of 7 a.m. to 3 a.m., you know, certainly wouldn't be something that would be considered lawful under the Basic Conditions Act, provided that that employee is earning under the threshold and hadn't contracted out of that basic term. So I think what's interesting there is that it's not only the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. It's also collective agreements and sectoral determinations that we have to consider. So you mentioned a little bit earlier, you said, look, we've had some difficulties in the labor market. And I think what we're seeing is on the positive side and sometimes the negative side, our highly unionized workforce environment. And what's really the core of the issue here is if we were to implement a four-day work week across all sectors, is that those terms in those collective agreements and in those sectoral determinations, take retail, for example, it's highly regulated hours of work, they can't be unilaterally changed. Similarly, contracts of employment, which regulate hours of work and place of work, for that matter, can't just unilaterally be changed. You actually require the consent of an employee or employees who have entered into these collective agreements or who are subject to these sectoral determinations. And that means that you have to go in and negotiate. It's not necessarily just a consultation process. It's let's get consent and let's all come to an understanding. And I think that that's not necessarily the case in a lot of the countries, the European countries particularly, who have successfully piloted an example of a four-day work week. So I think that just touches quite basically on our legal requirements. But another very interesting legal issue that arises is the issue of overtime,
sure,
which is equally highly regulated. And what the BCEA says in terms of overtime is it says any hours worked over and above your ordinary hours of work. Now, if you're moving to a four-day work week, notwithstanding the fact that you know you're being paid on that five-day week, your ordinary hours of work technically then becomes the 32, for example, as opposed to the 40 or the 45. Where does overtime kick in? How do we start looking at shifts if you're running continuous weeks in certain sectors? Shifts are then going to start changing, which is also a term and condition of employment. Mm. And I think that we're going to see a lot of nuances there. But, you know, from a purely corporate approach, if we want to call it that, the formalized business sector, it becomes a little bit less complicated. And I think really boils down to employee productivity. Can we have employees working 4 days with remuneration pegged on a five-day week, still maintaining the same levels of productivity, that we were seeing before?
Sure, and on the point you're making around productivity, there are a couple of, quotes that I'd like to read. Coming from, CEO Adam Hazni, he says, our revenue went up this year more than we had budgeted. We delivered on products on time or ahead, where we have done, I would say, the things we are able to measure have all been positive. And also coming from Microsoft Japan, a four-day work week boosted workers' productivity by 40%. There are many people who are spending more time at the office than they need to, says Juliet Score, who is an economist and sociology professor at Boston College. And also we're hearing that if work were organized more efficiently, she says, employees could get it done in a shorter period of time, go home and have a better life. And it brings me back, and I guess to the point that were two points that were saying that we kind of softly touched on. One, what was the birth of the 9-to-5? And how did it inform the regulatory framework that either then is covered in the basic conditions of employment or the collective agreements or sectoral determinations and any related issues around overtime there? So as far as I understand, that came right after World War II on the back of the reindustrialization, and it then became one of the things that then got embedded in our industrial relations and in employee relations, legislation. Around that. And so now we've got, take a step back and say, what are the things that inform the 9-to-5? And then coming back to this issue of productivity, so it's a two-layered question, Abigail. Where does legislation come into the context of productivity? Because even if you read some of the conditions around minimum wage, they'll talk about all of the things that inform the number, but really, is it associated with other profitability, productivity, etc.? Why is productivity now becoming a point of interest? And so maybe let's start with the first question.
So you're 100% correct. The genesis of this whole issue that we're discussing is really our typical historical understanding of hours of work. And post-industrial revolution, I think we start borrowing a lot from what was termed at that stage to be the American dream almost, which was that typical, go to work at 8 o'clock, come home at 5 o'clock, I've got my briefcase in my hand. A very typical understanding of hours of work, and very much you needed to have this separation almost of home and work, separation of church and state applying to the professional environment almost.
Yeah.
And interestingly, as early as 1926, there's a quote from Henry Ford that I quite enjoy, which he says, look, the five-day work week is not necessarily ideal, and the 8-hour work day is not the ultimate. And so I think we already see questioning at that stage from someone who I think was quite a forward thinker from industry, Ford, and to say, look, is this necessarily the way that things need to be structured? And I think that thinking began to really take hold when we started then talking about the new world of work prior to COVID. So we know prior to COVID, we started having that discussion of the fourth industrial revolution to say, let's start being more technology-based, let's start embracing this. And there was a real hesitancy to really embrace that fourth industrial revolution, to say, you know, can we actually start going into this? And then COVID, I think, plunged the entire world into a circumstance that they weren't quite ready for. And all of a sudden, we've approached that fourth industrial revolution at speed, embraced it, and finally now starting to talk about the fifth industrial revolution and incorporating AI. So I think we've had a rapid development there of the historical understanding of the manner in which we work and the hours in which we work. And I think that links quite nicely to your second question, which is there a disjunct there between the legislation and the way we understand productivity? And I think if you look at the BCEA and what it's there to do, it's there to protect employees in circumstances where they're earning below the threshold, and it's there to say, look, an employee can't contract out of the rights provided to it in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act. So it prevents exploitation, and I think that that was quite an important inclusion in legislation, and it should remain so, keeping in mind, as I've spoken about, in South Africa's labour force. But in different sectors, is this necessarily the most beneficial thing? Well, I think the answer is no. Mm. And I think that the way that we understand productivity, as you're saying, isn't necessarily in keeping with the way that we regulate the labor environment and what we call ordinary hours of work. And, you know, I think it's always quite interesting, because I think there's so many issues where you see a disjunct between legislation and how rapidly the world is moving, specifically in labor markets. I mean, you look at the way that majoritarian principles are applied to collective agreements and the extension of collective agreements to unions who are non-party. I mean, the principle of majoritarianism there is huge. And there's been a lot of commentary to say, well, you know, is that applicable? Is it worth the times? And so we see that disjunct quite often in the labor market. And it's really now just about deciding, is now the right time for the South African labor market to be following suit? And the World Economic Forum, which met in Davos in Switzerland, and I think it was the end of May, really, I think, considered this question with world leaders as more of a softer item on the program, to say, you know, what is the actual position on this? So I think you make a very relevant point there, and perhaps there's a disjunct.
Sure. And I mean, powerlessness, South Africans are, I think, about the seventh hardest working people by hours worked per week in the world. And so don't ever let anyone trick you into believing that you're lazy, because you do.
Study that says that South Africans are renowned for not taking leave.
Sure.
So we're hardworking, and we also don't seem to be taking our leave. So I think that's also something to factor in, to say, you know, are we going to see burnout? Because hybrid working sort of says you're available at all times. I'm standing in my office at the moment chatting to you. So, you know, what kind of implication does that also have on productivity? And I think it's just so incredibly interesting to see how we're going to evolve in this space.
Sure. And I mean, Abigail, you know, one of the also like studies that have been done around, you know, employee context in South Africa is some of the studies that have looked at absenteeism and presenteeism. And I think the more interesting number there is the presenteeism, right? And I think even Sanlam has also now done their own estimation, and I think that's in north of about 100 billion that it costs the economy now per annum in terms of presenteeism. And so when we've got people who are in office but they're actually not actually as productive, and this is what we're also hearing from CEO Adam Hasni, you know, guys are here but they're not necessarily being productive, and it's actually costing the economy a hell of a lot. You know, how do we then you know, think about that in the way in which we've got to have an agile legislative environment that is responsive to shifts in the market?
Sure. The agility of the law is something that you and I would have to have a lot more time to have a chat about. But I think that the core answer to that is employee wellness. Mm. So for corporates or for companies to really listen to their workforce in terms of what's actually required. And I think what we've seen in those jumps in productivity that you're referring to and the ways in which this model of a four-day work week is working is because it caters to the understanding that employees can't have the full 8 to 5 of their time dedicated purely to the office, and that there's other obligations that obviously need to be catered for, and that creates, I think, a more holistic view to employees as human beings. Mm. I mean, it sounds a bit soft from a corporate perspective, but it motivates employees, I think.
Sure. Abigail, we want that softness now. We want that softness.
But this is exactly it, and there's a move towards that. And I think the big move towards employee wellness and mental well-being in the workplace is so necessary and so needed, and definitely a reflection of what the South African labor workforce has been experiencing for many, many years. Mm. And I think that shift towards employee wellness is where this concept of a four-day work week is actually really coming from. To say, if we understand that there's all of these various elements to life that sometimes take us by surprise, for example, we don't have to worry about going to renew a driver's license because there's flexibility. I can spend 2 or 3 extra hours in the evening catching up because I can go cater for that, as opposed to then trying to take half a day's leave. That really makes a huge impact to employees at an individual, personal level. And I think rewarding that and providing employers with more autonomy creates a motivation to work for the company, which has an implication on the bottom line. So, everybody wins if it works.
Abigail, I mean, just on that point, I mean, I guess, and I'm, as you're talking, I'm just reflecting on an earlier point you made around consent and negotiation around employees for such, I guess, a policy shift. But, that didn't seem to really take place when, COVID hit and people are moving into these hybrid working models. How was that a little bit different to what we're seeing?
So I think it's important to look at it from a sector-specific perspective. Yeah. So the mining industry didn't experience lockdown in the same way that the formal corporate sector did. And I think that's really the key issue here, is that it's not going to look the same for everybody. So retail, for example, same situation. It was only in the most stringent levels of lockdown where retail wasn't and remote work wasn't possible for them. So it's really sector-specific, and that point on highly regulated environments, that's where that comes in. Sure. Where, overtime work, shift systems, being paid by the hour, those are quite relevant to industries like that. Construction, for example, as well. And they experienced hybrid work very differently to us in the corporate sector. And so I think that's where that understanding comes from, is this maybe something that could be implemented in certain sectors, but not necessarily in others, because of the extreme regulation in those sectors. Mm,
definitely couldn't have been implemented for attorneys, because they always pretend to work way longer than they actually do. But getting just into the last question, Abigail, I mean, when we think about the shifts that are taking place in the labor market around, the gig economy, and how this then can also impact Section 9 of the Basic Conditions of Employment. I understand that various economies are responding differently to the gig economy. San Francisco have now recognized, for example, Uber drivers as employees, the UK as well, etc. And so Basic Conditions of Employment, one would need, one, the satisfaction of the definition that you're an employee. But now we've got this Uberization of the gig economy. What does this all mean in the context of this conversation?
So I think platform work is hugely contentious, in the sense that we haven't seen the same kind of progression with Uber drivers in this country as for example in the UK, and even Nigeria. There's been a formalized process in relation to that, and there's legally it's quite interesting that the test in relation to operating as an independent contractor are things like supervision and control, and this idea that if you're not working under the direct influence of your employer and not necessarily being paid by a designated employer, but rather getting, a percentage of a tariff, that you don't, qualify as an employee and don't get those benefits. And I think if we start seeing a massive move towards things like platform work, we're going to have to start looking at that independent contractor versus employee model, and also that Section 200A presumption in terms of the Labor Relations Act of what constitutes an employee. So it goes back to your earlier point, really, about agility of the law.
Yeah.
And we saw the referendum by Uber drivers, not necessarily a strike, but the day in protest where they gathered, to give that referendum to say we need these rights recognised, because we do. Gig economy is alive and well, and platform work is a legitimate form of revenue in this country that perhaps needs greater regulation. That being said, the law as it stands is what the law as it stands, and obviously the difficulty is that requires implementation as it is. And I think that's what creates the tension in moving into the fourth industrial revolution, the gig economy, and now quite rapidly the fifth industrial revolution.
And as you said, Abigail, the critical thing now is moving into that implementation. And simply, if our chairman, Mr. Given Curry, is listening, it's 34 days, Nati, in the week. And if you come and you tell me anything, I'll say, don't talk to me, talk to my lawyer, Butcher. Thank you very much, Abigail.
Thanks for
100%. For our listener, that was Abigail Butcher, who's an associate in employment law at Cliff Decker Hofmeyr. Of course, telling us about the possible implications, particularly around the legislative framework for four-day work days, and some of the considerations around, you know, what does it mean for Section 9 of the Basic Conditions of Employment, collective agreements, sectorial determinations, what does it mean for overtime, and also, of course, taking a view around the sector-based nuances that would inform the kind of consent requirements and negotiations, as well as just talking about the need for agility in the way in which we design our legal frameworks. And so lots and lots and lots to unpack. Gig economies also, and you know, platform labor, broking as well. All of that is becoming a little bit interesting, and we're going to see how that develops over time. And that, power listener, brings us to the end of that conversation.